you're delivering something and the customer is learning about the pain points along with you, and it's a collaborative build, it's very credible and it's a very efficient way of building a new product. And that's essentially what we were doing. We were all learning together.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, I'm chatting to Creena Turley. Creena is a new wave of entrepreneurs who have built and started something during COVID, and she is building something we need urgently right now, and that's a hybrid working software solution. This is a fascinating chat about the future work, how to start a brand new business when everything is absolutely going crazy. Creena is a really experienced managing director and now entrepreneur, and is a really, really interesting insight into what it takes to build a business in 2022. We talk about the future of work. We talk about how companies are going to evolve. We talk about what that means for you as a business and how you can start to manage your staff in a much more efficient way. Spoiler alert, no one's got it figured out yet, but Creena has some incredible insights which she shares with us. First of all, I want to say a quick thank you to my partner, Sage. Sage is the number one provider of payroll, accounting, and HR solutions to small and medium-sized businesses just like me and you all across the world. To find out more about how Sage can help you get prepared for self-assessment and payroll year-end, click the link in the podcast description. Speaking of sponsors, if you're interested in sponsoring the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast in 2023, we are now open for applications. We are accepting sponsors up until the year end, and we will be accepting sponsors all through 2023. So if you're interested in partnering with us, drop me an email to gary at mrgaryfox.com or go to mrgaryfox.com and send me a message from there. Let's get straight into today's chat with Creena. Creena, welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Gary. Great to be here.
Thank you for joining me. I'm looking at your background there. It's a standard Dublin day, I think we'll call it.
It's a really wet day in Dunleary. I'm expecting someone to be like slammed against the glass at any moment. We've got wind, we've got rain. I thought we had snow earlier. But
this is the beauty of remote. We don't even have to go out in it because we can do it remotely. There's a nice little tee up for later. You haven't been in Dunleary much, though. You've been traveling a huge amount in the last couple of weeks. Tell me a little bit about that. So first of all, just give me an overview of what you guys do, and then just tell me where you've been in the last couple of weeks, because you've been on a busy, busy mission.
Sure, yeah. So how we describe ourselves are experts in hybrid working. So we provide software to help organizations just make hybrid working work for their companies, for their employees, and for the management team. So, you know, we spent the last couple of years building a really good solution, and now we're beginning to see the kind of the fruits of our labor as more and more companies come on board and start looking to us for that kind of support. So we've been kind of traveling salespeople recently. We were at the Web Summit in Lisbon, which was brilliant. Our CTO, Carlos Rodriguez, is from Lisbon, so he came over with me, and it was a really, really enjoyable experience. And then we were at the business show in London, which is another huge event in the Excel with 25,000 people. And we've just been traveling over and back. We're back in Lisbon to meet a client next week, and then we're up in Belfast actually later in this week because we're in the finals of the Seedcorn competition. The Intertrade Ireland Seed Corn Competition. So,
what is that? I've heard a lot about it, but I actually don't really fully understand what it is. So what is it fully?
So it's a competition for startups, and there's a really good kind of prize purse to it. But they also take you through putting together a strategy for your company, and they bring all boats rise, I suppose. They have very early stage startups, and then they have a competition level for companies like us that have been around for a couple of years. And they look at the best and the brightest of what's coming through in the Irish startup ecosystem. And it's very much about investment. So when we go on Thursday, we won the Dublin round, and happy to say we won the overall for sustainability and low carbon solution here in Ireland, which is really nice because we put a lot of work into that side of it. And when we go along on Thursday, we're going for the big prize. And we're also in a room at the end of it with loads of investors who want to hear about the business and learn a bit more about Capella. So it's great.
I often think about this. How do you balance your time? Because there's so many things to do as a startup. Like, there's a lot of distraction. We talked about this briefly earlier. There's a lot of distractions between. There's so many things happening now. How do you balance your time and prioritize between this is a must do and that would be a nice to do if we've time?
Yeah, so it's a real challenge, but you know, my co-founder, Victoria Yannikos, and myself are both from sales backgrounds. And the kind of the philosophy we have in the business is that the customer always comes first. So if we're looking to fill out an application for a grant, or we're looking to raise money, the customer, whatever they need will come first, and that will come second. And once you kind of have that focus, it makes it a little bit more clear of how to split up your day. Obviously, there's a lot of benefits from filling out those forms and applying for those grants, but we're building a business and we always look after the customers first.
So where did this all start?
This all started actually in Toronto in 2020. I had been running a business that specialized in workplace design and in employee engagement. And I had stepped out of the MD role of that business to try and internationalize it. And I was over in Toronto looking for businesses to acquire or partner with when my husband rang me and said that Leo Varadkar has closed the schools. This thing seems to be a thing, this COVID thing. I got a note under the door of the hotel room saying that I wasn't to leave the hotel room and they'd be serving food at the door.
Oh, wow.
And I was with Enterprise Ireland over there and I was using their offices and the Enterprise Ireland guy rang me and said, we're closing the EI office. And I was due to be there for another week. So really, really bizarre moment where I was sitting on the bed in a hotel room in a country where I didn't know anyone. I had no personal contacts. I'm looking at Trump saying he's closing the borders. I'm talking to my husband who said he'd run through Aldi and there was no tins of anything on the shelves anymore. It was just really bizarre. So I got a flight a few days later back, and I came back on an empty flight from Toronto. There
really?
Were three people and the airline staff flying back St. Patrick's Day. And I just knew that what I had been doing, the budget wouldn't be there for a while on that. And I just wanted to do something different, and I wanted to do it for myself and for the family. And so
was that the spark, or was this something sitting behind? Was this something you'd always kind of thought about, oh, when the time is right, or oh, when I have an idea, I'll have a crack at it? Or was this just suddenly one of those moments where you're like, yeah, I'm going to
change? Honestly, that was the spark. It was one of those moments. So I didn't necessarily have a great plan. I didn't have any plan, but I knew that change was coming. So I just sat down and informed myself, and I moved from kind of a corporate job with a steady salary and with, you know, working for someone, albeit running a business, but working for someone, into the world of startups and entrepreneurship and running your own business. And even that was a bit of a journey, I have to say. You know, starting a business in a global pandemic, a new product to a new market. You know, there was a lot of education for both the customer and myself around that. So it definitely wasn't the easiest of paths, but here we are. We're doing all right.
Still here. That's the main thing. Two years in. Tell me, what... Because this is kind of the stumbling block a lot of people have. They want to be their own boss, or they kind of have this idea and they're like, oh, when the time is right. What was the final decision you made? How did you come to that decision? I know you said change was coming there, but what was the, right, it's now or never, I have to do this? Like, because what finally tipped you over the edge to do it? Because that leaving a steady job at that time, a steady job anytime is tough and challenging. But at that time, it was probably seen as madness by some of your friends and colleagues.
Yeah, well, you know what, circumstance pushed it, because I had moved out of the MD role. Now, there was someone else in it. I couldn't just like go back into it. That wasn't an option. And it would have been grossly unfair to try and force myself back into that business, which was probably going to be going through a difficult time, like every business was in Ireland at that stage and around the world. So circumstance. And then, do you know what? I'd reached a stage in my life where financially we were stable. You know, I leaned on my husband, and I kind of, together, we made the decision that the time was actually absolutely fine to do this. And I did it.
What was the idea?
So I knew that employers now needed a lot of support for staff who had just suddenly gone remote. So everyone's sitting at their kitchen table. I knew the law. I knew enough around the law for workplaces and health and safety law. I went back and I actually did a qualification in health and safety law in the workplace. And I understood that employers had to carry out risk assessments for employees who were working from home to make sure that they were set up. And we were hearing all sorts of stories around productivity and around kind of the challenges of people working from home. So I got together with a really, really clever technologist and with my co-founder and with a guy called Neil Felton a few months later, who's our customer success manager. And together we built a solution for employees who were working from home to carry out remote risk assessments, to make sure that they were set up right, to carry out ergonomic training, to put together equipment lists for employers so they knew what employees needed at home. And, you know, if you had 1,000 people or 100 people, or I think we've done up to about 3,000 employees all within a few weeks, you can't drive around to their homes. The solution was really, really slick. We had people done within anything from 6 days to 2 weeks from very early on using AI and sentiment analysis. And it was a really good solution, and it ticked the box for the employer in terms of health and safety compliance, and it really helped employees out because we all kind of just landed where we landed, and you know, we're not ergonomic experts. We did our best, but as a company, we could see people were working in bedrooms, people were working in utility rooms. We saw people working from cars where their Wow. partner was in the house with kids and they were out in the car. You know, so if you talk to physiotherapists and doctors, you'll hear that there was a huge kind of uplift in musculoskeletal injuries, neck and back pain and stuff like that. And that was all because we were sitting on kitchen chairs you're not supposed to sit on a kitchen chair for 10 hours a day.
So your immediate idea was, right, there's going to be a massive uptake here in people that need proper ergonomic assessment. We're going to cater to that straight away. You mentioned there you put together a team. How did you do that? Because I think that's a stumbling block a lot of founders find in terms of putting together a really good team. So how did you do that, especially in times of such challenge?
Yeah, so I have known our CTO for a number of years, and he was working away in one of the big technology companies. And we were just talking, and he was looking to kind of move into probably more entrepreneurial startup. He'd had his own business before. He was interested. So he came on board a few months later, and my co-founder came on board almost immediately, which is brilliant. She's based in New York, and she was looking to start the entrepreneurial journey as well. It made a lot of sense. I had unfinished business with North America when I was flying back from Toronto. I knew I'd be back. I knew I wanted to build a business that was international. So that worked really well. I've known her for years as well, and she's a super person. So she fit very well with my skill set. And then I worked with Neil for a number of years. He was coming to the end of his kind of contract, and he came on board after he left the other company. So it just kind of fell together nicely, to be honest with you, Gary.
You make it sound so easy. There's people out there pulling out their hair going, I can't find a co-founder. She do it so fast.
Well, you know what? You find people in the most unusual way. You find a lot of people in the early days through your own network. Yeah. And you have to find people who want to work with you as well as people that you want to work with. So, you know, it's no harm just reaching out and talking to the people you know.
I think that's the beauty as well, of just building a network over time in terms of it's organic. I think a lot of people network for the sake of networking when they have an ask. I think that's the difference. Networking when you have an ask and you're like, oh, I need to find a co-founder, as opposed to going through a seasoned career where you're like, yes, you're building up all these people who have competencies and you know them. You know them well, because I've seen a lot of people get co-founders just from a chance meeting or something, and it's like a marriage, you know, to jump in without fully knowing each other. So the way you've done it is really, really nice.
You can't afford to make a mistake in the early days of a startup, you know, like as I ran bigger businesses in the past, it's kind of a 50-50 as you're hiring strangers, you know, some work brilliantly, some it just doesn't mesh. But you can't afford to have those kind of numbers in a startup with four or five people. It's just, it can destroy the business if you get the wrong person. So yeah, I really would recommend, now that we're talking, going within your own network or networking when it's not this serious event where everyone's shoved together in a room. Just kind of let it happen organically and naturally. Just be nice and you'd be surprised what comes out of, especially here in Ireland, what comes out of a personal network.
Yeah, we're hugely lucky here in Ireland. Like, I mean, we have a very strong, close community. So I think it's the people you see repeatedly over time, the people that are sound, like you said, the people that are nice and continually give back. They're the people that, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint. I think a lot of people think startups have to be this urgent thing that need to happen right now. And oh, if I don't do it now, someone else is going to steal the idea. But in reality, you're better off spending your time building these people around you and getting the right team, because then you're a perfect example of someone who's built it over time. And then when the time is right, you already had the key components you needed. You weren't scrambling around just trying to find a random person to join you.
Yeah. And you know the old saying, you know, you hire for attitude and then you teach skills. That's the same across co-founders, across the C-suite of any business. You obviously, if you're hiring an accountant, the person has to have gone through an accountancy degree, that helps. But I think if the skills and the training can come, but you'd need to be able to work with people, because I also read that having a startup is like being punched in the face every single day. And every single day there is a moment of shock or a moment of horror and a moment of joy and elation. And you want to have the right people with you on that journey who you know, who can see you warts and all, who can see you just after you've been punched in the face.
It's a pretty accurate description. So talk me through the first kind of 6 to 9 to 12 months, because they're often the most challenging. What was your kind of first, you talked about the ergonomic product you got out to market pretty quickly. Was that the first thing you did?
Yeah, that was the first thing we did. And, you know, suddenly you have this brilliant idea, you know, people have to do it by law. So you're ticking all these boxes, you know, you're going to have a really successful business. And then nobody wants to take your call and nobody wants to talk to you or, you know, so I suppose when you're in a startup, it's about just keep going at it every day, move forward slightly. And that was a very important kind of lesson in the early days. We never built an MVP that we were testing with people. We built something that we could sell straight away, because if people bought it, then we knew we had something to sell that people would buy on a larger scale. So while Carlos was building, I was selling and Victoria was selling, and then Neil was stepping in and helping get the customers across the line. So I guess that was a tough period where we were learning about the product, learning what people would buy, explaining to people that they had to do it by law, and trying to get people to actually switch it on. So that was kind of what the first 9 months we were about. We knew that we wanted to build that kind of recurring income on an international basis. So we knew we needed the platform. So we quickly moved beyond just the ergonomic assessments. While they were really good for cash flow, because we bootstrapped up until now, we knew that we needed something stickier that would be recurring. And that's when we got really into the hybrid working supports.
I asked this question. I did a panel on Friday and I asked everyone on the panel, how do they differentiate between the signal and the noise? Because the world is a super noisy place in general. And often it can be very hard to cut through to actually what's really going on, especially when you were building this business. Stepping back, we're in the middle of COVID here now. You're trying to build a brand new business. How did you differentiate between all the noise that was out there and actual things that were going to happen and then stick?
Yeah, so I'll go back to the network again. You know, you start within your own network, you build out your own network, and you talk to people in a human way. And as I'm doing the sales, or Victoria, or Neil, and now we're beginning to grow a little bit more, it was very much a consultative sale. And the kind of companies that we got on board were really credible companies who wanted to do right by their employees. But that also gave us a little bit more credibility for the next company. And now, you know, we're across government departments, we're with some really big blue chip companies, but we're also with the small companies who just need support to do this right, you know. So you also get referrals from clients that help. And then when we wanted to get outside Ireland, we went for partnerships. So, for example, in Portugal, we partner with a company called Bound Health, who are in Portugal, and we sell to their clients through them.
Okay.
And that's worked very well for us outside Ireland.
So partnerships are the way to grow. You made a very good point there. Workvivo were on the pod this week, and they made that exact same point. There was two co-founders there, one technical, one CEO/sales, and they were doing that exact thing. Joe was building furiously in the background, but John was actively out there selling even before they had a finished product. And they pivoted multiple times going, actually, no, that's not the product. Here's the other product. How do you talk to someone? How do you talk to a potential client like that and build that trust without suddenly, because a lot of people look for like track record and pedigree, and you touched on a little bit there, but how do you have those initial conversations? Because this is what holds back a lot of startups, the fear of the no and the fear of like, oh, sure, we're only still figuring it out. How do you overcome that?
So even though we had a product in its early stages, I had huge confidence in the product and in Carlos to deliver. So we never had a wipeout moment with the product. It always delivered the way we said it would deliver, and that was down to Carlos and being such a good developer and such a good technologist. And you often get technology people saying to salespeople, you know, you're selling the dream and I'm delivering the nightmare. And certainly we had that conversation a couple of times, but I never went too far beyond what he had already. And if I did talk to clients about additional features, I knew that he could deliver them, and you know, sometimes we'd say, okay, we don't have that now, but we will add that in for you. So we never sold beyond what we could deliver, and we never had an issue with the product. So I guess for a salesperson, that the absolute anxiety comes around selling something that's going to let the customer down. I never for a second felt that the customer would be compromised or I would be compromised. We were delivering at a very high level very early on, and we were learning because we were so closely associated with our customers. We were learning their pain points, and it was new to them. So, you know, if you're delivering something that's been around for years and you're asking customers about their pain points when the whole world knows that this is the problem, that's one thing. If you're delivering something and the customer is learning about the pain points along with you, and it's a collaborative build, it's very credible, and it's a very efficient way of building a new product. And that's essentially what we were doing. We were all learning together.
How do you open up that level of transparency between you and the customer, though? Because I think sometimes companies want to kind of appear like, look, we've got it, don't worry, you know, it's going to work. Versus what you're saying there is a very collaborative, kind of almost a two-way dialogue. How do you do that without kind of maybe say losing a bit of credibility, or kind of like, you know, them kind of going, oh, I haven't got time to like help them build their MVP. I'm going to go with, you know, another solution.
Yeah. Well, sometimes. So a level of honesty is needed, and sincerity, I'd say. You know, we're selling usually at quite a high level. And, you know, sometimes I'd say it didn't work out because the incumbent corporate solution, one. But it's funny, those kind of clients are coming back to us now, because where, say, a competitor might have a solution that allows you to book desks and book parking and just book practical things, our solution goes way beyond that in terms of planning for how hybrid working will work for your organization in the future, and the deep data around the reporting and stuff. So what we found is that some customers said, you know what, best of luck to you, but we're going to go with this tried and tested, practical, cheap and cheerful solution. And that's cool. But now, you know, they're in large offices where maybe people aren't coming back into the office. They're struggling to create any kind of excitement around that. They're struggling to understand what the future of their workspace will be and needs to be. And, you know, even things like, is there a link between people working from the office and career progression as opposed to people working from home? You know, we're starting to get really deep into that now. We're starting to report on DEI. You know, is there a whole cohort of people who are working from home, and this culture that you've built?
What is that acronym for anyone not familiar? What is that, DEI?
DEI, diversity, equality and inclusion. So, yeah. So you might have people where you've built a really diverse and inclusive workplace over the last 10 years. Now there's a whole cohort of people who are sitting at home and feel that they don't have the opportunity to come into the office as easily or to be included. Or, you know, maybe you don't see it like that, but maybe you'll have a little silent quitting going on because people feel excluded. So, you know, we can get ahead of, we can certainly report on the barking dog, but we can get ahead of the silent dog who bites harder that's coming in the next couple of years. So, yeah, it's exciting. It's really nice to be a part of such a rapidly evolving space.
I was keen to get you on because this is just a massive space at the minute, and it just feels like we're at this seismic moment in the world where work in as itself has changed and is changing rapidly, but there's still a confusion, and again, the signal and the noise. People are kind of like, I said this here already, people are kind of like sticking their finger up in the air and kind of going, we're trying this.
Yeah.
Where are we? Like, where are we right now in terms of how people are working?
So first of all, we're flying blind because it's very hard to kind of, without any data, it's very hard to understand what people want. How, you know, people say one thing, I don't want to go back to the office, I want to work from home. But actually, when they do go back for one day, it's really nice because they're meeting people and they're not going from Zoom call to Zoom call. They come back out of the office with a pep in their step. They've had those human moments, people call them water cooler moments. They've had human moments where they're talking about their family, or maybe if they're living alone, they're going back into a socialized environment. Likewise, if you're house sharing and there's four of you in an apartment in town, you're going in to do some focused, quiet work, and that's working really well. So I think people might be saying one thing, but actually the experience is slightly different. We can see the employers, what they're planning for in terms of return to work and what employees are willing to do. They're coming together. So you have employers who are saying, look, 3.5 days in the office. And you have employees who are working back towards 2.5 days. So you're kind of coming closer to what's acceptable to both parties from all of the kind of the surveys, the credible surveys that are being done. How do you start? I suppose the important thing is to take the first step in trying to get people back in. And that can be events. That can be creating a peripheral connection between people who are sitting from home and people who are in the office. So we do that on our system. We always draw up the actual floor plan of the office. So it's a 3D render that looks really cool.
Oh, that is cool. I like that. Yeah.
We pop people's faces.
Yeah,
we pop people's faces on the chairs. So I'm sitting in the kitchen and I can see everyone who's there. And human nature is that I go, oh, she's in today. And I want to go in. So I check and I go, do you know what? I've been trying to see. She's just back from maternity leave. I must go in. And, you know, it creates that kind of peripheral connection that I'm talking about and a bit of excitement. So that together with a positive experience when you go in. So if I'm driving on the M50 for an hour to get to an empty office, And I'm walking into God knows what. And then I'm doing Zoom calls or Teams calls from my desk. That's a negative experience. Yeah. So, you know, if you have that 3D render with the little faces and all that, you know that you're going into a busy enough office, or you know what you're walking into, and you can pick an area to sit that is, you know, has the right mix of people for collaboration, has people you want to catch up with. And I guess there's a bit of planning around that. On the other end of that, then, the employer gets to see how the office is being used, how people want to use it. They can turn off a floor. Say you have five floors, they can turn off the fifth floor in terms of booking on our system. And they can see whether it's actually needed anymore. Can they sublet it? And where the sustainability and the carbon neutral element comes in from what I was speaking about earlier is that our system can help manage cleaning. So I don't need to clean a floor if no one's been there. I don't need to turn on the lights on the floor if no one's going to be there. So you're managing utility bills. And we give heat maps of occupancy and usage and stuff like that. So you can see very visually how the office is being used. And if you have 20% of desks being used, but your meeting rooms are busy all the time because people are coming in to meet, then maybe you need to redesign the office. And there's an awful lot of talk about redesigning offices. But I would say don't do it on gut. I used to do this for a living, so I'm all about it. But don't do it on gut. Get the data, let it run for a few months, and then design what you need.
This is a great point. I found this so weird. Like, so many employers ripped out their offices during COVID. I'm like, how do you know what's like? They spent massive amounts of money refitting everything. Oh, it's going to be more collaborative. But exactly like you said, I was kind of going, how do they know that? Like, have they some sort of like secret mystery ball into the future, or were they just guessing?
No, I think it was that there was so much pressure on operations and facilities staff to know all the answers. And when we all ended up at our kitchen tables in March 2020, it was temporary. And so what it was what it was. We all got in there and plowed ahead and did our best, and that was fine. But then the return to work, there was this huge expectation that it would be absolutely seamless and that facilities managers, operations directors, all of these people, HR directors, would get this bang on first time. But it's iterative. And 2.5 years in, it's iterative. So if you're developing a hybrid working policy, there's no harm in saying to employees, okay, so this is the policy. We're going to do it for 6 months. We're going to come back to it. We want your feedback on it. And even taking feedback, it doesn't have to be a free-for-all. It can be feedback that channels in and you do what's best for the organization. You know, it doesn't always have to be what's best for the employee or what the employee wants, but it does have to be responsible for the employee and it has to work for both sides. So I guess, why did people suddenly start spending €1 million on redesigning their office spaces? It's because there was this huge expectation to just get this right day one.
Are we going to see a complete reshift in the work week? Are we going to see, you know, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5? I think that's more or less gone now. But are we going to see the days become different? Are we going to see the work week is Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in office? Or how do you see this shaping out long term? Or will it be different company to company?
Yeah, so it's different industry to industry. So we have some law firms as clients. We have government departments. We have design agencies. Each one of those has a different pattern. Different expectation of employees and from employees, and different accountability, I suppose, for delivery and for the organization. But what are we going to see? So what do we see? I have a big screen in the office that gives the trends across all of our client organizations, and it's really interesting
to
see.
Very cool.
Because obviously, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday are busier in the office. No shock there. Okay. What else can I see? I can see office occupancy nudging up really slowly. So if you put our systems in, are you going to get 100% of people coming back the next month? No, you're not. But over time, what you can see is the gradual climbing of people coming back into the office towards that 2.5, kind of 3-day week, I would say. So I'd say that's where we're going. I can see that more women are working from home. I can see things like that as we're looking forward. So yeah, there's some real trends that are going to affect the future of work in Ireland and across the globe. You have 58% of people worldwide were working from home at one point in 2020. Like, that is mental. Mm. So our market is absolutely ginormous. When you start drilling that down, you're getting kind of early adopters of technology companies who like our software and like the reporting that it's giving them. And then compliance-based organizations like government bodies, like accountancy firms, law firms, and they very much like to understand the structures of hybrid working. But any knowledge worker who's working globally can use our product. So it's a really, really interesting space to be in. And we're starting to get big numbers that are building good data.
That data set is going to be so impressive and so important in the next couple of years. Like, it's going to be...
There's things that people haven't even thought about. So we're very much about compliance, right? And our system looks after all of those barking dogs that I was talking about. But say you have 20% of staff in the office and someone has a heart attack. How do you know that you have someone in the office that day that's trained in first aid? You know, these kind of things that would come back not only to bite you, but will bite the guy on the ground who's having a heart attack. They need to be spoken about, considered, and a plan put in place. So our software does all of that. And, you know, we're finding that that's really useful for organizations who are trying to just organize hybrid working in general.
They're the kind of hidden things. Like, they are hidden, but they're not. But when you said it there, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's so obvious that, you know, because it's all a bit loosey-goosey at the minute. And everyone's kind of like, oh, I'm in today, I'm not tomorrow. Oh, I'm not going to go in today, I'm not going to go in tomorrow. And I thought that the idea of shutting off the floors, like, it's so clever. What do big companies do with these massive offices now? Because I'm in town quite a bit and it's kind of quiet. A lot of places are pretty quiet. Like, what is going to happen? Like, the joke in Dublin was, you're either building an office block or a hotel. So, like, what's going to happen with all those massive offices that have just been built?
I think this, look, people are going to get more sensible about the amount of space that they need. There's a lot of pressure from multinationals to get people back into the office. And then the managers on the ground here are saying, well, it's not as straightforward as that here. Because, you know, I do think that it's going, the 5 day a week is gone in the office, that genie is not going back into that bottle, as we would say. So, but I do think that, like, the IDA do a brilliant job of bringing organizations into Ireland. And I think there's a big long list of companies that will take the space, the free space. I wouldn't be worried about Dublin turning into a corporate ghost town by any means. I think there's a long line of people who'll fill that space. And if an organization has those five floors and they want to sublet one of the floors, I think there's plenty of takers. So it's going to be a shift for sure. And what we're really strongly saying is get the data, make data-driven decisions, but don't be afraid of making decisions. Just don't, you know, carve them in gold. Know that they may be changing in 6 months or a year as you understand how the organization's working.
This is the thing. There's that phrase, the best decision is the right decision, the next best decision is the wrong decision, and the worst decision is indecision. Yeah. How do you get companies to make decisions when it's an incomplete data set? It's like you say, use the data, but at the minute, we're still really early. So how do companies who are listening kind of going, okay, I need a solution here. How do they make the best decision they can now without the full data?
They take one step forward and they start building that data, okay? Because there's, you know, even going into a board meeting as an HR director or a facilities or operations director, there's a huge comfort in going into a board meeting with some really good data to show the board how this is working for the organization and make recommendations. Going in without any proper solid insights, I think, must be pretty distressing. So I would push to try and start building that data, even if you're building it yourself within your own organization and not using an external company like us. And I think that's the first step forward. And then, yeah, there will come a time where you have to make a decision. And there's a huge amount of organizations out there who haven't. And if that's the case, then they're not alone. There's plenty who are in this situation. But first step is data.
Our office is going to look different. Our office is going to like completely change how they look in terms of like these horrible cubicles and everything. Are they going to look like a fundamentally different space in the next couple of years?
Yeah, I think they are. So what we're probably moving towards is the office as being that hub. And then the spokes are either your kitchen table or your home office. But also third party workspaces. And we're seeing more of that. So we're onboarding a client in the US at the moment who are interested in bringing on third party spaces for employees who are all around the country. You know, how do you give someone on the other side of the country that office experience? And you really, you know, as adults, we don't make friends as easily as we did as kids. We make friends in work. So the social element of the office is absolutely huge. And you're seeing that coming back. So I think that the future of actual office spaces will be for social, for collaboration, for focused work if you're in a house share situation. But definitely it'll be a focused and target visit to the office. And that office may be your central hub, which is the center of your culture and all of that, or it may be a third party workspace.
When you say third party, you mean people like Iconic offices and shared offices like that. Is that what you mean with third parties?
Yeah, okay. 100%. So we've got a couple of kind of WeWork spaces and different third party spaces on the platform for different clients, and it works very well.
And that feeds then into your company data set of how people are using.
It helps for the organization to see how those spaces are being used. Because, you know, if you're just paying a bill every month and you're wondering, do people actually go there? I know employees are saying we want it, but do they go? You know, that's interesting as well.
It's like the thing of joining the gym. You know, people are like, oh, I'll keep the membership because, you know, next month I'm definitely going to be the fit new me. I think the same, it feels like the same is happening with offices. People are like, oh, next month, yeah, definitely going to have like 3 days in the office. So like, how does that balance?
Did I leave my credit card statement on the desk?
That what this is about? I think that's everybody. I think it's like, no, not because someone was asking me about I wear a Whoop and people are like, oh, is that good? And I'm like, yeah, it's really good. And like, it gives you a nudge. Like, it's not going to drag you by the hand out to go for a run, but it's going to go, yeah, you're really not like recovering or you're not training. So I think it's the same with like gym memberships and anything that's like health-based. I think people have good intentions, but if you're a company, good intentions ain't going to pay the 20-30K office bill every month. What's been the most surprising thing you've seen in the data? Like, what's the thing you're like, wow, that's bizarre. I'm surprised.
Do you know what? Some of the spaces that people were working in for really good companies were shocking in the early days. And, you know, it's not that the company didn't care. It's that, oh God, you know, let's not open this can of worms. It'll be fine. And then the cases started coming and we were kind of dragged into a couple of them as the expert witnesses. And you could see, like, people were genuinely very affected by just being thrown out there at home, albeit at home, but with no guidance, no support. From a very physical point of view, it caused all sorts of problems. And I think that was the biggest shock. You had some of the best and brightest organizations in the country and across Europe and the US. And, there were people who were working from the same bed that they slept in all night and would sleep in again tonight. You know, it was very weird.
Psychologically, like it's hugely impactful.
It's terrible
to have that kind of space. I mean, I think people were like, oh, work from home. Oh, it's great. Grand if you have the space. And like, I'm lucky enough to have a dedicated office and similar with my wife upstairs. But like you mentioned earlier, I remember sharing houses with like 6-7 people. You know, I remember like you're in these spaces, you'd literally be fighting for the kitchen. You're not going to sit down there all day. And there's people who literally have a box room. So it's not quite that simple. It's so nuanced. Anytime there's a nuanced problem, it takes a long time. I think the kind of work from home movement was probably a 10, 20 year movement that was happening, and it had to happen.
It was 30 years. We did 30 year development in almost immediately. It jumped forward by 30 years according to all the research.
30
years. The other thing is, you know, just in terms of what's the solution around people who are in those environments, because we were in lockdown, no one was allowed to go anywhere. Actually, health and safety law is really practical around this. As an employer, you have to stand over the safety and the health of someone who's working for you, whether you're working from the office, the car, home, whatever. That's your role. If they're in a position where they're not safe and they're not set up right working from home, then they come back into the office where they will be. And even in the lockdown period, that was perfectly acceptable. If someone was in a bedroom basically 24 hours a day, that was hugely impactful on their mental health and on their physical posture and pain. It was fine to say, listen, there's a space for you here in the office. Come back in. If they couldn't go to another space or sort something out, that was fine. And that still is fine. The onus now is on employees to show employers that actually they are suitable to work from home. And if they're not, then the employer can't stand over letting them.
It's such an interesting space. It really is. Like, I remember a mutual friend of ours, John, who introduced us, telling me about this idea. And I was like, oh my God, that's such a good idea. It's one of those ideas, just like, it's so obvious, you know, but again, not simple. It's, you know, it's a very complex, nuanced issue. So what you're working on is tough. What's been the biggest, it's probably a list like this long of the challenges you faced. What's been the biggest challenge you faced over the last couple of years?
That's a good question. I would say letting people know about Capella, getting out there. You know, when you start as a startup, you don't have big marketing budgets. You're trying to do things on a shoestring. You're trying to do your own PR and your own marketing. Inevitably, when we got in front of someone who had the need, they used our product. But we kind of tried to get the prospecting right, and we ended up using a third party company around that. But it took us a while to figure out our path towards scaling.
Interesting. So you got a third party to start delivering leads?
Yeah, so we used another software company to do that. But I guess I got an insight into how our own customers feel in when you're trying to look for a solution and there's just hundreds of them and you haven't a clue. And you know, but luckily we struck on a good one and it worked quite well. And now we're kind of changing that up slightly because we're beginning to scale and at a slightly more rapid pace. So we need to do that, and we're taking the funding in. We're just closing a pre-seed round to help us hire some people to help.
What does the next, you've kind of hinted at there, what does the next kind of like 12 to 24 months look like for you? I mean, it's difficult in the world we live in now. We'll chat about that in a second. What does that look like for you in an ideal world?
Yeah, so we're obviously, I've just said we're taking some funding. So we're giving away some equity in the business. So it's not a light decision to make for a company that's bootstrapped up to this point. And we're doing it for all the right reasons, because we can see that we're at the point now where we're starting to scale and we just want to add some fuel to that fire. We've set ourselves some quite ambitious targets in terms of that scale and how it will look. So we'll probably be going back to the market now in the next 12 months to raise a more significant round. And that's really it. It's about growth now. We've got the product market fit quite nicely. We're moving out of Ireland with some of our clients, although our Irish clients are obviously very very valuable to us and will continue to be so. But yeah, that's we're going more kind of international and we're going for it at this point.
Super. I mean, we talked about this a little bit earlier in terms of to close around now is pretty impressive, and it's also pretty bucking the trend of what's happening currently in the tech space. what's been your kind of reaction and feelings to kind of the last 2, 3, 4 weeks as someone who works kind of in the employment engagement space?
Our reaction from whom? Sorry.
So what's been happening in the tech world? The tech world has been having a kind of an implosion moment over the last couple of weeks. What's kind of been your kind of thoughts? As someone who sees this intimately every single day, what's been your thoughts on the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very volatile environment at the moment for certainly the larger companies. Small companies like us are flying safely below the explosion, I would say. You know, because I came from that kind of corporate background where we were buying a product and selling a product, or we were charging design hours, the link between valuations and turnover has always been very clear to me. The link between actual customers and raising funding was very clear to me, and it's something that I'd be quite sensible about. I never really got the massive valuations based on a whisper of wind and some development work in the making. I never got that. So I think that the companies who don't have aren't generating revenue, unless they're med tech or something like that. But companies who aren't generating revenue and who are still building and who are looking to raise, they need to have something very special in the current environment with investors to actually get people to write some checks. It's not like a couple of years ago, I have to say. So that's kind of where I would see it at the moment.
It's actually clouding, I think. I tweeted this on Saturday. It's actually clouding a lot of the great work been done by indigenous companies like yourself, because big tech just gathers so much news and it gets so much attention from the mainstream media. You talked about there, it can be hard to actually break through and actually get people to know about what's happening. It does kind of cloud over, you know, the hundreds of people getting let go. It does cloud over people like yourselves hiring one or two people. There's kind of like this discrepancy whereby people should be kind of shining a light on indigenous startups like yourself. For the next kind of like, you talked about there about raising. What was it like to raise from someone who's come from quite a corporate background? What was it like to actually go out and raise for the first time?
Do you know what? It took a while to get my head around it and to understand kind of the rules and the pitch and the pitch deck and the nuances and where you go and who you talk to. And I did New Frontiers, which is a brilliant program run by Enterprise Ireland, I have to say. And they try really hard to educate entrepreneurs and startups within that program. But you're kind of learning it before you're doing it, probably a year before you're going out to market, or in our case, probably 2 years before we went out to market. So you have the theory, but then actually understanding it, understanding how to put a valuation on your own business, going to market, understanding the players within the ecosystem. It took a while. I was surprised by how kind of all over the place I was, until suddenly it just narrowed down and makes sense. And Intertrade Ireland run a really good kind of mentoring session around taking investment for startups. And it's definitely well worth reaching out to them as well, because they're the real practical steps that you need to complete.
Nice. I'll put New Frontiers. I've heard really good things about New Frontiers. I'll put New Frontiers and Intertrade Ireland in the show notes as well.
And Enterprise Ireland. Enterprise Ireland have been brilliant. We're one of the HPSU, so high potential startup companies, and I couldn't say enough positive stuff about them as well.
Were there any mistakes where you're like, oh, Rachel, I can't believe I made that one. It seems so obvious now.
Plenty of them. You know, even trying to get your pricing right as a startup, and you know, you go too high, you go too low, you go the middle, but the middle isn't the middle anymore. And you know, as you're trying to explain your pricing, you can see people getting lost, and you go, okay, so that's too complicated. So you bring it back and you make it more simple. So now we just have super simple pricing that we know is cost effective and will stand up against any of the competitors in that. But that was a journey getting there and understanding it. And you know, once you've overpriced something, it's gone. that's the really upsetting thing. You know, the contract's gone. You could have easily done it for less, but you were trying to get it right. And so, yeah, I'm glad that bit's over because that was pretty torturous.
And underpricing, even worse, where you're like, oh yeah, we'll just, yeah, we'll prove ourselves and then we'll raise. And you can always go, yeah, down, never back up. That's the kind of thing. And it's human, yeah, psychology.
You know, you can always add a feature. You can bring new features and you can charge for that. And it's the not being at the table at all. That's the depressing piece because they've gone with someone else. You know, I didn't enjoy those learning days.
It's hard. To make something simple is really difficult. Like, startups are mainly psychology of yourself and others.
Yeah. And you know, when you're back in the kind of jobs I worked in before, I would buy for one and I would sell for whatever multiple of that I wanted to sell for. But you know, as you start a technology company, you're getting supports for hosting from some of the big players there. And so your costs aren't actually your costs. So you can afford to do a little bit lower, but then, you know, so yeah, you gotta be really careful. But it's something it's the plaster you have to rip off early on. You need to find out where you exist. And the market will often set that for you. And then it's down to you to see how you can increase that price over time.
Perfect. Karina, I'm going to do a quick fire round now after this, but before we do that, where can people learn a little bit more about Capella and yourself?
Yep. So I'm on LinkedIn and Capella. We obviously have a website, capella-ws.com. So Capella Workplace Solutions is our full formal married name.
Brilliant. I'll pop that in the show notes as well. Karina, that was absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much. I learned a ton. And I think for people listening, it'll just be so impactful because I think we're all kind of stumbling around in the dark here trying to figure this out. So thank you so much for coming on. And it's Capella, and I'll put that in the show notes. So Karina, thank you so much.
Thanks, Gary. Have a good day.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.